Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk to a national security researcher about a recent legislative effort to remove the social media app TikTok from digital devices, starting with the federal government. There are aspirations for a ban here in Wisconsin as well. Now, what are some of those recipes you keep coming back to cook over and over again? You probably have at least a few that have become classics, at least in your kitchen. One of my favorites, you've heard me mention it if you listen to enough Food Fridays, is an easy shawarma-style chicken that works great cooked in the kitchen or out on the grill. In a new cookbook, our next guest found and perfected all the recipes that have become her own classics. She's here to share them with us now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your classic, can't live without them, make on repeat recipes? What separates those favorites from the rest of what you cook? Do you have a set of tried and true classics that you don't change at all, or do you add some new recipes to your classics list? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Deb Perlman is the creator of the cooking site Smitten Kitchen. Her new cookbook is called Smitten Kitchen Keepers, new classics for your forever files. Deb, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back on.
What is it for you? You've encountered lots of recipes, your own and others. What is it that makes the cut to become a keeper for you?
It's something that clicks when you make it and you're just like, that is the one. That's the one I want to make forever. And it's not always just about it tasting good. Obviously that too. Once you've got that out of the way, it can be about ease of preparation too. Because even if it tastes perfect, use every bowl in the kitchen. You're not going to ever make it again. So I want it to have a balance of effort and reward.
And this is a book you write, you've been kind of working up to since you started the Smitten Kitchen website. I guess the whole idea behind the website was to make your own forever files like we used to keep in note cards and boxes.
Absolutely. That's always what I've been on the hunt for. The perfect pound cake, my perfect summer lasagna, whatever it is. I'm not looking to have to do research every time I want to cook something. I want this to be the one. And so here in this new book, I'm trying to amass as many the one recipes as I could track down by publication time.
Now, you've probably made a couple few pound cakes over the years. Like, what kind of effort goes into on these recipes saying, yeah, those were all pretty good. This is the keeper. This is the one.
Now, pound cake is often very good and sometimes amazing, but I wanted something even better. So the pound cake in the book, it not only is one bowl, you start with melted butter, and in fact, do not start with cream butter. It does not get the same perfect creamy buttery crumb, and it gets so tall, it fills out the entire pan, and you get this crispy, dark brown lid on it, almost like this bark-like top, and I just love the drama and the flavor. It's just perfect. I put some sour cream in for complexity, and this is it. I'm never making another pound cake. I'm done.
Talking to Deb Perlman of Smitten Kitchen. Her newest cookbook is called Smitten Kitchen Keepers, New Classics for Your Forever Files. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is in your forever file? That perfect recipe that you love to make again and again, or the people in your life make you make for them again and again. Do you have a favorite that you picked up maybe from Smitten Kitchen? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Get a few recipes from Deb. By the way, she shared them with us. We've got them at WPR.org/Food Fridays. Food Friday, singular. Food Friday. Deb, let's check out one of those recipes you shared with us since we were just talking dessert a little bit. Let's go there. A challah cheesecake bun. Tell us about these.
So these are a breakfast bun, but they're not as sweet as your usual cinnamon bun. They're a little bit milder. I think they're more, to me, they remind me more of a cheese Danish. But I talk a bit about my dad who passed away a couple years ago in this, because he grew up in the Bronx and he always used to speak warmly about having cream cheese and jelly sandwiches from the local deli after school. I have not really encountered this, but I think the part that he left out is that when you put cream cheese and jam together, it tastes like cheesecake. So that's how we got these cheesecake buns. I use a challah dough, which is very similar to what you use for a cinnamon bun. And then we roll it up and we brush it with eggs, so you get that dark brown glossy finish. I really love these for breakfast. They're not as heavy and sweet, but they're really decadent and they're so fun to make for friends. I love it this time of year. It's so great when you're having people over for breakfast or brunch.
Now, going through this recipe, I actually kind of flipped through cookbooks, what I talk about on Food Friday, to see like, okay, are we going to be able to get all these ingredients? And yet, in this case, yes. I think through your book, you've really gone out of the way to not have super fussy, hard-to-find ingredients. Did I have that about right?
Absolutely. I'm completely obsessed with not just having ingredients that everybody can get. And I know everybody is a vast, vast category. Who knows where you live? Maybe you live for... But in general, these are, for me, mainstream ingredients. If I put anything fussy in, my mom's going to call me and tell me she can't get it at her grocery store and complain. So I don't want my mom calling me. That's the first part. And I also look out for package sizes a lot. Like, I want to use, whenever possible, the entire container of sour cream or the whole package of cream cheese or the entire box of pasta. If I can make the recipe work with it, I will. I hate having a little bit of extra.
Now, are these capers, they're capers because Deb Perlman likes them and likes to make them? Or do you use feedback from those who eat them to determine what makes the cut here?
I would say that I'm probably more picky than anybody else. But yes, I absolutely get feedback from the family and from friends whenever possible. There's a lot of like putting something out on the dinner table and like grilling my husband and kids over it. I'm a real hoot. So it's a lot of what do you think? How's the texture? Does this need more acidity? Can we eat yet? No. You have to tell me what you think. it's definitely, I want to make sure everybody likes it and they're asking for it again. But I also just want to make sure that I didn't hate making it. Because sometimes I will put off making my own recipes if I feel like they're too much work. And that is always a sounding alarm for me.
I can't remember where this was in the book, but you had some advice for dealing with picky eaters in the household. And as I recall, the gist was, yeah, ignore them.
God, so I'm like, feel like we were going to call the Department of Family Services. I mean, I do not mean to make lightly of ignoring your children. You should always pay attention to their needs and stuff. What I wanted to say is that I have one child who eats everything I make, and then I have one child who eats almost nothing of what I make. And I want you to know she keeps me extremely humble. But I just think that within reason, you make sure they're fed, and then you try to make what you want. Because if you only listen to them, you might have a life where you eat macaroni and cheese every single night, and half the time they don't even want it. So I feel like whenever you can, try to make what you're craving and try to sell it. Maybe I'll make sure I leave out the spicy part, or if there's a mix in, I'll leave that off. Or if we're doing a taco night, maybe I keep the components separate so it's not too intimidating for a picky eater. But I feel like I want us to fight for the food that we love so we don't get burnt out on cooking.
Excellent. Now let's check out another recipe. It's a winter squash soup, which is one of my favorite things to make. I make it all through the winter as long as the squash doesn't rot, or I'll keep some in the freezer. You've got a winter squash soup. Okay, I get that. Something I haven't done with red onion crisp. You've got this topping on this soup. Tell us about this red onion crisp, please.
So I'm not you. I do like winter squash soup, but I do not love it. No, I like it, but I found it a little bit boring, the classic one. I wish I could love. So I wanted to challenge myself to make one that I would want to make forever. And from here, I really had fun with the flavors. We add some ginger and cumin and a little extra garlic to the base. So there's a little bit of heat. We finish it with lime juice. And then at the very end, you just take a little bit of minced red onion, some dried coconut and some chili flakes, as much as you want. And you just fry them until they're crisp in a little puddle of oil. And I love this spooning this topping on. This is definitely something I leave separate for the pickier contingent. But it's really fun. And I really love the texture and the complexity you get out of it. And even though that does sound like a fussy extra step, we are not starting with roasting the squash. It all goes in one pot and it's really quick to make the rest of it.
And this sounds great. And it seems like this is a place where the key is don't just mix it into the pot of soup. This is something you put on at the point of eating. Don't put it in with the leftovers, right? Otherwise it's just going to like blob into the soup.
Yeah, I love the textural contrast in the soup. I love a little finish of acidity. I should also mention this is a vegan soup. It has coconut milk in it, not just to make it vegan, but also because I really love the flavor here because we're going with cumin and cilantro and some coconut milk, and it really works so well together with the ginger and everything else.
My favorite thing, if you want to, I mean, yours is perfect, but if you want to try an imperfect one, my favorite thing with my winter squash soup is right at the end, like a lot of diced cilantro, like fresh, and not just like a little dainty sprinkle, but like it's a vegetable in the soup right at the last minute. I don't know. That's awesome.
I love it. I love the things that we add at the end. For me, it just takes a simple soup and it just kind of lifts the whole thing. So it's doesn't feel like each spoon is monotonous.
Exactly. We're talking to Deb Perlman of the cooking site Smitten Kitchen. She's with us on Food Friday today to share her new cookbook. It's called Smitten Kitchen Keepers, new classics for your forever files. We've got three of those keepers online at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a recipe or recipes that have reached a classic status in your household, in your family? Is it something that was handed down maybe through generations or something you discovered in the last year that was an instant hit? Let us know about it. Ask Deb if you need help cooking, putting something that you make all the time over the top. It's a little bit boring. You want it to be less boring. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Deb Perlman of Smitten Kitchen about her latest cookbook. It's called Smitten Kitchen Keepers, New Classics for Your Forever Files. Love to hear about your favorite recipe you go back to again and again, the one that works out just right that you get requests for. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Not calling in. I don't know. Maybe you're not confident in your cooking or you just don't want to brag. This is the Midwest. You can brag a little bit about that favorite recipe, the one that is a big hit at the potluck or with guests or with the kids. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find a few recipes from Deb at WPR.org/Food Friday. I know we're pretty humble here in the Midwest, Deb. We don't like to brag about our recipes. How do you get your followers on Smitten Kitchen to speak up and say, hey, this is my favorite keeper?
I love to hear about what people cook for friends and family. I love to hear the recipes that you know they're keepers. You know, whenever you make that, like your friends say, you cannot show up to like Christmas without this. So I'm really obsessed with people's passed down recipes or the thing that you found on the back of a box one day or just some random clipping your mom had from 1978 from a magazine that became your favorite, because we all know which recipes of ours are like the ones that you just don't need to touch it. There's no reason to keep looking for a new one.
Now let's check out another one you shared with us. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. Green angel hair pasta with garlic butter and roasting, garlic whole bulbs here, right?
Mm-hmm. So that's actually the cover dish. And I love it because it looks like just, it's so brilliantly green that everyone's like, what is that? So this is so fun. I think this is such a fun recipe because in the heyday of roasted garlic, we always used to roast heads of garlic with a little drizzle of olive oil and spread it on bread. I feel like this showed up all the time in like the 90s and the early 2000s in salad at restaurants.
And it was awesome. I loved that.
It was great. I feel like it's coming back around. But as I started writing this book, I still felt like it was in a distant memory. So one New Year's Eve, probably pre-pandemic, so a few years ago, instead of roasting in a little drizzle of olive oil, I roasted it in a stick of butter, like, oops, sorry. And then we made this whipped roasted garlic butter, and it was amazing. We were spreading it on Christini, and it was amazing. But I don't really make Christini on a Thursday night. So I wanted to find a way that I could use this amazing flavor more often. And for that, I just threw it in a blender, and I added a bag of spinach. That's it. You blend it up, you add a little pasta water, season it well, and you toss it over spaghetti. And it is just so decadent. I think I've been surprised by how well it goes over. A lot of people are telling me their toddlers and little kids like it because I think the kids find it really fun that it's bright green, but it doesn't really taste like spinach. It tastes like garlic butter.
Well, now we've got tons of callers. Let's go to Laura in Madison. Laura, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Laura?
Well, I wanted to tell you about one of my go-to recipes. It's called Cola Pot Roast, and you make it with cola and carrots and onions, and you roast it slow and slow. But the reason it's my go-to, other than the fact that it's delicious, is it makes the best pot roast sandwiches for leftovers.
Oh, I love leftover sandwiches from that. Now, what's the cola doing? Does it end up being kind of sweet?
Yeah, it's kind of sweet and caramely. It makes the onions just amazing.
Oh, I bet. That sounds fantastic. Laura, any pot roast thoughts, Teb?
I love pot roast. I came kind of late to it. I don't remember my mom making it when I grew up, but I have a pot roast recipe in the book that's a little bit like, it's a little bit fancier because I add some harissa to it, but it's basically just, and I'm actually making it tomorrow night. It's basically a boneless chuck roast, a big can of tomatoes, and then a little bit of cumin, coriander. You put a head of garlic in there, a little bit of carrots, and then you add just a couple tablespoons of harissa. It doesn't make it spicy. It just gives it a little complexity. That's like the one of the two like semi-fussy ingredients in the entire book. But I think it's such a wonderful flavor to have in there. And you slow cook it for a few hours. And it is just, it is so good. It makes your kitchen smell amazing. And sometimes, because there's quite a bit of liquid in pot roast, sometimes when I want to make it more of a one pot meal, I'll actually just throw some rice in for the last 45 minutes. There's enough liquid in there that it can cook it. And then you really have this incredibly cozy, decadent dish.
Laura, thanks for that call. If people are looking for harissa, that's H-A-R-I-S-S-A, if you're trying to find it online or on a shelf. Back to your calls now. Teresa is with us in Green Bay. Teresa, hi.
Hi. I called in because you didn't have callers. So one of my go-tos is my father's spaghetti recipe. It's really tomato-based. And it's a quick story. When I first got married, he didn't want to share. He was like that with recipes. So one day when he wasn't home, I went to the house, found it in the recipe box, copied it, and that's how I got it.
Now, did you ever make it for him, though, or did you keep your secret?
I didn't keep my secret. I never made it for him, but I let him know that I stole it.
Excellent.
I have adapted it because I went, I don't eat red meat anymore, so I adapted it to ground turkey, and it works just as well.
Fantastic. A little larceny in our cooking there. Deb, seeking those old family recipes and, you know, making them our own can be a lot of fun.
Definitely. It's also touchy. You know, you don't want to, you're not criticizing the recipe. You
right.
just need to go in a different direction with it.
Thanks a lot for that call. Megan is with us now in Madison. Megan, hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. How are you guys?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I just wanted to start by saying I'm a huge Deb Perlman fan. Oh my gosh, our whole family is smitten with Smitten Kitchen. And actually, I use your recipes as my staples, and then I expand off of them. And I wanted to highlight specifically your pancetta and bean pot pie recipe. Oh my gosh, everybody loves it. I've done variations off of it. Like I always start from A to Z, you know, initially. And then the second time I made it vegetarian. And then I've just used your recipe for the lid of that pot pie for so many of my other soups just to convert it into a pot pie. So thank you very much from me and my entire family. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Well, thank you. That's a really great tip. I have never thought of turning another soup into a pot pie just by putting the pastry on it. That's great.
You want it to be kind of a thick soup, right?
It could be, but I bet, you know, like, I mean, a beautiful flaky pastry lid. I mean, even if it was imperfect, I think the flakes and everything else would be amazing with it.
Thanks again for that call. And Deb, she brought up, I think a really key thing to my cooking is, all right, the first time with a recipe that's outside of our comfort zone, try to follow it pretty close to the letter. But it's a skill that I love. I've developed over the years to like, okay, that's my starting point. What do I have? You know, I don't have all the ingredients. How can I spin off it or make it something a little different? Can you talk about how we can develop that skill?
I think it's a fantastic idea. I really like doing that too. And sometimes it's hard for me too, because I'm like, oh God, that's not the way I make biscuits and whatever. But the thing is, if you don't do it that way, you'll never learn anything new. You're only going to make things the way you, and how am I going to be surprised by a technique that I didn't think was going to work, or something easier, or something that really made something taste better? And the only way that's going to happen is if you follow a recipe to the letter the first time. After that, you're free. Go do anything you want with that recipe. It is your kitchen. You're in charge. I am not one of these people. I love comments on recipe sites. I mean, partly because I have one, but I love hearing how people change things. It's your kitchen. It's your shopping cart. Make it the way you want it to be.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Deb Perlman about her new cookbook, Smitten Kitchen Keepers, New Classics for Your Forever Files. We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line, Deb, who says she loves starting her cooking with whatever's left over. Can you give us some inspiration for taking that, you know, leftover, when we do have that little bit of something left in the fridge, and building recipes around it?
Well, that would be a really great use for a pot pie. That pancetta, white bean, and Swiss chard pot pie is actually in my first book, and I think there's a version of it on my website, too. I say I think, like I don't know my website, but there are a lot of recipes.
There's a lot, yeah.
So, but I did, I think I shared that one when I was promoting the book. So it is on the site too. And I am very clear about it. The pancetta is completely optional because I think it completely works without it. I wanted to do a hearty vegetarian one. Anyway, but I feel like you could definitely, if you had leftover roasted vegetables or, you know, some chicken you wanted to shred up, you could add it. Think of it as like a foundation point for, you know, different kinds of pot pies. I also think it can be really nice. I mean, we're about to have a quesadilla night, so some things go really well. I mean, you kind of add cheese to it and everything's resolved. I also like using leftovers for a pizza topping, even if it's not that traditional. There's a pizza recipe in the book that has almost a focaccia-ish crust. It's just a little poofier and airy. And I feel like it takes really well. You can really load on the toppings without it getting flat and crispy.
And Deb, in our last few moments, we've got a lot of snow here in Wisconsin. I think you've got a bit of snow coming on the way to you right now.
Okay. What we is have not a fan?
Yeah. What is your favorite thing to make on that cold, snowy day? You don't want to go outside. What is that comfort food for you on the cold, snowy day?
I feel like we got to make that pot roast, and I think we should probably make that pound cake too. I feel like we've been talking about it, and it would be just right for a snowy day.
Fantastic. Deb, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Deb Perlman, creator of the cooking website Smitten Kitchen. She joined us today to talk about her latest cookbook, Smitten Kitchen Keepers, New Classics for Your Forever Files. You can find a few of the recipes we talked about today at WPR.org/Food Friday. We got the green angel hair pasta with garlic butter. That sounded good. Winter squash soup with red onion crisp. I'm going to try that topping in my next batch of squash soup once I finish the current batch of squash soup that's in my fridge, and the challah cheesecake buns. And by the way, you can still share your go-to favorite all-time keeper recipes. Let us know about them. Email ideas@WPR.org, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you have a link to the recipe, all the better. That's on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, look back on the year in music with NPR music experts, and you can join the conversation and share your favorites. Was there a new release this year that really spoke to you? That's coming up Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday, the U.S. House Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol is holding a public hearing. We'll bring you live NPR coverage starting Monday before noon, starting about 11:50. The committee is expected to consider possible criminal referrals and to vote on them. Their final report is expected later in the week. Join us for live NPR coverage of the January 6th hearing Monday, starting at 10 to noon here on Wisconsin Public Radio and online at WPR.org. Now, could the Chinese government be using phones in the U.S. to mine private data or even government secrets? That's one concern raised by lawmakers behind a push to ban the hugely popular social media app, TikTok. Senators passed a bill to ban the app from federal government-owned devices earlier this week. The House has yet to vote on that. Some states have done the same. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you share some of the concerns of lawmakers who are trying to ban TikTok? Whether at the government level or in general, do you use the social media platform? How about your kid or grandkid? Do you pay much attention? Do you worry about its use for data harvesting, for propaganda? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dave Schrader is a national security research strategist at UW-Madison, where he focuses on information technology, cybersecurity, and cyber national security issues. He's also research director for the Wisconsin Security Research Consortium. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
I want to start with a listen to U.S. Congressman Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin's 8th District in the northeastern part of the state. He's been advocating for some kind of crackdown on TikTok. Here he is on Fox and Friends.
See, the issue is not just that the CCP via ByteDance, via TikTok, can track your location, can track your keystrokes, can compile a dossier on you, and they're hoovering up tons of data from the United States and all over the world while they don't afford the same data reciprocity to American companies that are operating in China. The issue increasingly is that a lot of young Americans get their news from TikTok, which will allow TikTok to censor news according to the dictates of the Chinese Communist Party.
So you gave a list of concerns about TikTok there. Let's start with what we know about TikTok. It's on charts the sixth or seventh most used social media platform in the world, owned by ByteDance, he mentioned there, which is based in China. How important is that ownership picture to this whole story?
Well, I think that's really the key factor here, because you know, ByteDance, you know, it's not a state-owned enterprise, but in China, no company is truly private. So there is an element of control that the Chinese government can exert over ByteDance, and that flows down into the products that ByteDance operates, and that includes TikTok. So I see this as a real problem, because even if TikTok nominally operates most of the time on the surface as just another social media app that's, you know, looks and acts and feels like the other platforms that people might use, whether it's Instagram or you know, Facebook or Twitter or whatever, the problem is ultimately the ability to influence what is shown or not shown to people via that platform.
Yeah, let's start there. One of the concerns, propaganda, either by commission or omission, putting things in to algorithms, leaving things out of algorithms. What kind of concerns do you have about how the leaders of China might influence what shows up on for TikTok users here in the U.S.?
So my concern is twofold. One is, you know, just the general content that is shown to people while using the app. What content are you going to show to an audience, you know, based on how you want them to behave? And I think one of the most stark comparisons is between the TikTok platform that we see in the United States and the similar platform in China, because TikTok itself isn't even available in China. So if you're a Chinese user, you can't access TikTok. You will be using Douyin, the analogous product from ByteDance that's targeted at the Chinese marketplace, which has a whole host of different rules that are implemented on it. The likes of which are, if you're under 14 years old, you can only use the app for 40 minutes a day, and you can't use it after 10 p.m. And you are going to be shown videos that are deemed to have a positive social impact. So the algorithm that controls what you see if you're a young, you know, American or European user are going to be much different. And they're designed to, you know, keep you on the platform, keep you engaged. And we've all seen things like, you know, these different challenges, like, you know, the milk crate challenge, where people are trying to see how many milk crates they can stack up. And, you know, it's almost a joke when people fall off of them and get injured, or, you know, various quote unquote challenges at the end of the school year of, you know, people doing damage to their schools. I don't think those are things that are, you know, you can say, oh, well, they just go viral because they're popular. Well, is that the only reason they go viral, or are they going viral because they're pushed and chosen by the platform to go viral? There's two sides of that coin.
Now, that's the kind of propaganda side of things. There's also concerns, specific efforts to ban federal government devices, and in some states, state government devices from having TikTok loaded on them. Is there a national security concern if particular federal devices have this app on them?
Well, the app only has as much permissions or capability as a device is able to give it, as the OS of the device, you know, whether it's iOS or Android, is able to give it. But those permissions are pretty deep. And, you know, so there are real data privacy, data jurisdiction intelligence collection, surveillance concerns that are attendant with TikTok, because it has access to a lot of data on your device. It has access to your fine location. It has access by default to some of the most subtle details that you're able to get from a mobile device. And, you know, some might say, well, that's the same types of permissions that other social apps, from Facebook, Google, similar, might have as well. But the difference is that those are U.S. platforms. They're operating under a U.S. legal regime. They are largely focused on, advertising and trying to sell you things. Whereas TikTok is, you know, maybe again on the surface, you're looking at monetization with ads and things like that, just like any social platform. But there's another layer to it, which is that the Chinese government, whether ByteDance is witting or not, can have access to that data en masse. And so, you know, what it winds up being with an app like that, where you have over a billion routine monthly users, and a lot of them are Americans, and a lot of them might be, you know, government officials or people that the Chinese government is interested in, whether or not is on a government-owned device or not, you have access to that data en masse, and it becomes a mass surveillance and intelligence collection tool as well.
Talking to Dave Schrader from UW-Madison, cybersecurity expert there, looking at calls to ban TikTok from federal and state government devices, and maybe completely in the U.S. You can join in with your thoughts and questions. 800-642-1234 is the number. Tom joins us now in Madison. Tom, hi.
Thank you. Yeah, a question and a comment. The question is, can the people in China, or these forces in China, hack into other platforms and mine data and location and information like they do on TikTok, even though it's not their own thing? And the other comment is, I find it disingenuous for Republicans to be concerned about propaganda when we have people like Ron Johnson posting COVID disinformation on Rumble. He's not allowed on YouTube anymore because this stuff has been debunked like crazy, but you can still go to Fox News, Newsmax, and now Rumble to get information that is obviously propaganda.
Tom, thanks for the call. The first point, could China get this information through other means without TikTok?
So, yes, they can and do, but those require offensive cyber operations on the part of the Chinese military or intelligence services, and they absolutely do get information that way, but it takes more work. If you're installing something voluntarily that is essentially a beachhead on your local device that allows similar types of access to data that they would be interested in, it makes it much easier. And also, when you have that large of an audience that you can broadcast, the narratives that you control to, that becomes an extremely effective information operations tool. To the second point, one thing I would say is that it's interesting that the Chinese government and their own propaganda mouthpieces often use the, hey, look at what the U.S. is doing, or the U.S. does it too, or this isn't any different from, you know, than Facebook or their own politicians or things like that. That itself is a propaganda narrative talking point that the Chinese and Russian propaganda mouthpieces use. Now, that doesn't mean that there may not be elements of truth or other valid discussions to have about those topics. But the key difference when we're talking about a U.S. politician or a U.S. citizen on U.S. platforms versus a foreign government is just that. We have our own marketplace of ideas that U.S. citizens, U.S. politicians, U.S. candidates operate in, And, you know, the free speech and the battle of ideas, those are all of our own problems. What I have a problem with is foreign governments either overtly or covertly via narrative control on platforms like TikTok, inserting themselves into our political process.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Dave Schrader, National Security Research Strategist at UW-Madison. State and national lawmakers are aiming to ban the social media app TikTok from government devices. Some saying, hey, ban it completely. We're talking about potential threats. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? Are you a regular user or viewer of TikTok? What do you think of the idea of banning it or changing its terms of service? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with UW-Madison's Dave Schrader, National Security Research Strategist. We're talking about a push to ban the social media app TikTok from U.S. government digital devices and beyond. At least some bipartisan support out there for both of those options. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, concerns, questions, maybe your experiences with TikTok, 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Isabel is with us in Madison. Isabel, what do you think?
Yeah, it seems like, you know, we hear about countries like China banning social media apps and access for their citizens. And I'm curious how this would differ and if it's going to lead us down a path where we're opening doors to banning other social media apps in this country, and if we're setting a precedent. And maybe there is finer legislation that would ban what we want to ban specifically, but not the actual app.
Interesting. Isabel, thanks for the call. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, I think that any legislation that may be forthcoming, like the bipartisan legislation that's out there now, does have to be very specific about what it actually is that's being banned. And I think the specific issue here isn't about, you know, TikTok as a platform per se. It is about the fact that there is control that the Chinese government can exert over that platform because of it being a Chinese platform. There have been some proposals about things like data jurisdiction and even having some transparency into the algorithm that have been suggested for instance, TikTok US, you know, the platform that operates in the US and the company that operates TikTok in the US. Those are interesting ideas, and they would all be very complex. And that, you know, there is a point too about banning a platform, setting a precedent. So I think that we do need to be very specific here about things like we don't want foreign-owned apps to be run on, you know, for instance, government-owned devices in the United States. That's something that's reasonable. As far as preventing the app from operating entirely in the United States, you know, there are any number of technical and other measures that would that could get us there. But I do worry how that would be used, you know, for instance, by adversaries of the United States to, again, highlight, you know, hey, there's hypocrisy here, and maybe give them a justification to be more aggressive in bans or internet controls in their own countries that wind up having a net negative effect.
Isabel, thanks a lot for that call. Dave, do you have an ideal outcome that you'd like to see, whether it's federal law or a negotiation or what, when it comes to TikTok?
Well, my personal view on this is that it's about awareness. And it's not just about TikTok. It's about all of the social platforms in particular, the platforms that are designed to keep you scrolling indefinitely, that are all looking for ways to, you know, inject that next item in your feed so that you stay in the app. We all need to be, you know, very aware of the information that we're consuming, where it's coming from, the interests and motivations of, you know, who's showing us that information, as well as, you know, some of the, you know, more technical things like what kind of permissions are we allowing all these apps to have on our devices? And one easy way of, I think, kind of decoupling ourselves from the addictiveness of these apps is to not use the app at all, but to use the, you know, whatever the site is, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or even TikTok, via the web, and including on your phone. It's more of a pain, and it is, you know, it's not as nice, it's not as good of an experience, but that helps, you know, maybe, you know, you stay in the app less. And I think that you know, even something like a ban is fraught. There's a lot of problems with, you know, with a blanket ban, but we can make the choice of what apps we use and what apps we allow on our children's devices in our families, and we can help people be aware of what the risks are.
Let's go back to our callers. Rick is on the line in Boscobel. Rick, hi.
Hello. Aren't most cell phones made in China anyway? So wouldn't they be able to trace, bug, and prompt you to watch, listen to, and study you however they want anyway?
So we are able to, so that, you know, that's a good question. You know, a lot of the devices that we use are made in China. And, you know, we're able to inspect these devices at a supply chain level that security researchers, you know, would be able to determine with a good degree of certainty if there were any backdoors or, you know, capabilities like that, and, you know, put in the devices. And frankly, it's much easier to, you know, to spy on a target using other means at the software level than it would be to embed something in hardware at the supply chain. Now, the hardware supply chain argument is an interesting one. And, you know, there have been examples of undetected supply chain vulnerabilities that have been raised. And, you know, one example is with the DJI drones. That's a Chinese drone manufacturer, and it's been very popular even with U.S. government agencies, police departments in the U.S. And we realized that, you know, even if it doesn't have vulnerabilities now, that is a supply chain that's controlled by China. And do we want to be allowing, you know, those exclusive, you know, Chinese controlled supply chains to be in extremely critical areas? But, you know, the cell phone example is certainly an interesting one. That's why you see manufacturers like Apple looking, part of the reason you see manufacturers like Apple looking to move some of that manufacturing into the U.S.
Thanks a lot for that call. Dave, it seems like the fundamental issue here is we are entwined market-wise with China in so many ways, yet we have this largely adversarial relationship. Can we do both of those things at the same time?
Well, I'm afraid I don't have an answer for that one. I mean, clearly we have a lot of economic interdependence. We have had a lot of efforts at cooperation, you know, over the last five decades. But clearly there is an adversarial and highly competitive relationship that's emerging, and you know, and some would call it a new Cold War. And you know, China's interests in many areas do not align with those of the United States and those of Western countries. And so, you know, when we have these dependencies, we need to ask ourselves, you know, what can we do to look out for our own interests in a way that makes sense.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dave Schrader, National Security Research Strategist at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about the U.S. Senate recently passing a bill that would ban the social media app TikTok from federal government devices, calls for complete bans from some in Congress on both sides of the aisle, and potential security threats of the app on people's phones in general. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, the January 6th committee wraps up with a final hearing, or expected to be final hearing, and recommendations for next steps. We'll find out what came up in Monday's session. and chatbots. Machine learning and other so-called artificial intelligence programs are able to create text documents that can throw school papers into chaos. Find out what happens when the AI meets the term paper. That's Monday here on Central Time.